This is Michael Hansen. The Mind Web story this time is Crisis by Edward Grundin, copyright 1951 by Street and Smith. Woodward looked at his graphs for the last time. They eliminated a few possibilities and indicated a good probability that three were valid. Some 57 other vectors were possible, but not probable. And in a very few minutes, he had to recommend a definite course of action on the basis of them. A recommendation that was almost certain to be accepted. The council chairman called the meeting to order and waited until the 400 delegates became quiet. When he spoke, it was in a tired, quiet voice.
At this special meeting, gentlemen, we will dispense with the minutes and the usual formalities. You all know our subject. We are here to consider the voice. The voice, as the aliens have come to be known. To recapitulate briefly, we first heard of them when most radio communication was interrupted 36 days ago. A voice speaking good English with a rather high-pitched tone broke in. It introduced itself as a visitor from a nearby star system without giving a precise location. It stated that, with our permission, an ambassador was to be sent to Earth to see if we were developed enough for intercourse with other highly developed races. It asked that this ambassador be allowed a visit of 3 weeks with a typical Earth family, rather than be shown over the entire planet. Specifications were given as to the type of signal we should set up for landing purposes and the date of landing if we wished to accede. That date is now 2 weeks off. We have had three separate teams working on an analysis of the message. The chief of each team will now tell you his recommendation. They are Mr. Woodward of the International Psychological Association team, Mr. Gelfife of the team of the Society of Human Engineers, and Mr. Dever of the team of the Federation of Social Sciences. We recognize the difficulty of their task and the speculative nature of their results, which are, however, the best we have. Mr. Dever.
All we can make is a good guess. We believe the alien to possess a nervous system of Cantor's class 4 type. This means an organism who acts warily, plans far in advance, and is too rigid to do anything but retreat quickly or strike out spasmodically when its predictions are inaccurate. It would tend to have a strong ethical system applied to the in-group, and no concern with organisms not members of the in-group. If frustrations imposed on it are expected, it retreats. If unexpected, it attacks. Since it will be unable to predict clearly the course of development of human beings, it is, well, more than liable to feel frustration and to become hostile and aggressive. We recommend refusal of permission to land and signaling that we will not be ready for relations with extraterrestrial groups for at least 100 years. The aliens almost certainly see this as a possible reply and are most likely to withdraw for that time. At the end of that period, we can reevaluate the situation.
He sat down and buried his face in his hands. Those who knew him realized what he had lost. Dever, who had sought after knowledge from childhood, who had spent his life at research, who had the most insatiable of all desires, the hunger to know, had foregone the vast store of ideas and concepts the aliens would have provided. He had followed the logic of his science to its inexorable end, and the result was bitter for him. After a long minute, the president said, "Mr. Gelfife." And Eli Gelfife stood up, a serious, intent man who had made great contributions in the application of social science to the social system.
We essentially agree with Mr. Devere. Further, we suggest a marked increase for research and training in both the physical and social sciences for the next 50 years. Class 4 organisms are very unlikely to get along well with human beings who are Class 9. And neither is basically stable enough when their plans are thwarted. Contact between the two will result in frequent lapses of communication, which must end in violent collision. Eventual contact is certain. Let us arm ourselves against that day.
Some men need freedom and peace for themselves and for others. They work for it all their lives. Gelfife was such a man, and the knowledge that he was urging preparation for war rested more heavily on him than on any of his hearers. His poise had been good and his speaking technique excellent, but his face was gray. Woodward rose without waiting for an introduction.
We agree in general with the findings of the other two teams, but our recommendations are quite different. We think we've detected slight variations in the Class 4 pattern, which lead us to believe that the alien is much more rigid and inflexible than would appear from usual techniques of message analysis. We believe him to be an organism that lays long-range plans, checks them against empirical data, and then must follow them through. You see, in other words, if predictions are demonstrated valid in two or three checks, the alien is no longer structurally capable of abandoning the plan. However, if the empirical data do not fit prediction curves, the alien will withdraw from the situation and feel real emotional blockage to attacking this particular problem again. Before going into details of this, let me sketch the broad outlines of my recommendation. We let them land at a country estate we prepare. They find a family, a rather typical one, a staff of servants. We have been going over psychographs for family and staff, and I submit that Mr. Devere be the gardener, Mr. Gelfife and his wife, family, I'll be the cook. There are other recommendations as a matter of detail. Now then, in effect, this is a Class 4 organism with several major differences. As Mr. Devere stated, it is probably empathic and cooperative with its in-group, rather hostile with others. It makes plans far in advance, sets up prediction curves with a margin for error, and checks those curves. If there is agreement with the data, it must follow through. In addition, we believe its purpose here to be aggressive and probably exploitative. There seems little chance that aliens and humans could get along together without violent clashes and probably war. However, we can possibly turn this situation into a not unprofitable course. Now, gentlemen, as to details, what we have to do is...
The estate in Florida consisted of a large, low, rambling house built around three sides of a court. The fourth side was a lawn that sloped down to a small lake some 300 yards away. Beyond the lake, open fields stretched for nearly 2 miles. Some of the fields were newly planted and beginning to grow. Cows and sheep grazed in others. One very large field, about a mile from the house, was of hard-packed earth and was torn up in several places as if small bombs had landed there. A tremendous target with the outermost circle 50 yards in diameter was whitewashed on the ground. A steel needle, 20 feet long, with fins on the large end, lay in the target. Beyond this field, the hills began. Beyond the house were roads with a two-lane cement highway coming within 100 yards of the house. A single-track railroad paralleled the road and had a turntable at the end nearest the house. Off to the right stood barns, stables, and servant quarters. The exhaust nearly filled the small but beautiful valley. It had stood for many years, and there were now no signs of the furious labor that had gone into it in the past 2 weeks. The army of technicians had installed their equipment, tested it, and gone home. Only a typical family awaited the alien's ambassador. The small sphere had detached itself from the large cylinder under the close scrutiny of various cameras, spectroscopes, telescopes, and other instruments. With no evidence showing of what was keeping it up, it floated and circled slowly down to the far end of the lawn. Once there, it opened up like a flower and became a flat platform on the ground. Two beings walked off the platform, the sides of it curled up, and the reshaped sphere rose into the air and headed upward toward the cylinder. They had the general body shape and size of Shetland ponies. A heavy bone carapace covered the neck and back. The head had a large brain case which changed the looks of the entire face. It had a human quality, which probably came from both the bulging skull and the intelligent-looking mobility of the face. A long, flexible tentacle emerging from the base of the neck lay curled passively on the carapace of each. They stood quietly on the lawn, looking toward the house, obviously waiting to be received. Eli and Wendy Gelfife had come out of the house when the vehicle landed. They watched until the sphere was quite out of sight, and then Eli lifted his wrist and spoke into a small radio. Several minutes later, a sleigh pulled by three oxen appeared from behind the barn. Driving it was Mr. DeVer. In a few minutes, DeVer and the Gelfifes had driven up to the ambassador's and dismounted from the sleigh. Behind them, the tracks made by the heavy oak runners of the sleigh stretched across the lawn. Eli Gelfife moved forward and spoke.
It is a pleasure to welcome you. I am John Parsons, and this is my wife. This is my gardener, Mr. Spencer. We have a place for you, and are very glad you are staying with us. We have instructions to continue living as we normally do. You will be our guests. We have further instructions to answer no technical questions, but to allow you to inspect anything on the estate. Is that satisfactory?
The heavier of the two aliens replied,
My name is Arnott, and this is Kay Sid. We believe that the arrangement you state will be entirely acceptable. Food will be landed for us every three of your days, and we do not require to eat oftener than that.
Cook, the aliens do not require food, so you may discontinue preparations. Not knowing exactly what you ate, you see, we were preparing a wide variety of foods for you to choose from. Our cook, Mr. Wiss, was making lists of the chemical constituents of each to help you decide.
He took the reins, gestured his guests onto the broad, flat back of the sleigh and turned the oxen back to the house. Although it was only late afternoon, the sky was gray, and a chill had begun to creep into the air. The house was brightly lit. The tall chimneys of the kerosene lamps blazed with a warm glow. And Gelfife showed his guests to two large, bare chambers on the ground floor.
If you will describe the furniture you would like in here, I can have it made and shipped in by rocket plane within a few hours. You can control the temperature in these rooms by means of those levers which connect with the atomic pile we use for heating. The small wheel at the base of each kerosene lamp, you'll find controls the amount of illumination it gives off.
We will need some large, heavy cloths, blankets, or such like. And you probably have enough of them here. We prefer to sleep on them rather than anything else. We would like to see the house. Tell us. We have understood most families have children. We do not mean to be personal, but do you and your wife have any? And where are they?
Well, we have two boys of 19 and 22 years. Neither has been here for some time. The younger is away at college. He should get his degree in electronics next year. The older boy is serving as a mercenary abroad as a captain in a company of Lancers. If his campaign goes well, he may get a short furlough and be permitted to come here and see you. But tell me, how did you learn English?
Your radio waves are powerful and can be heard a good deal farther than you probably imagine.
Once we figured out that you were broadcasting in several languages, we were able to analyze the most prevalent one. We could learn your language from it, but get no consistent picture of your world. So many different kinds of people. So many different techniques and motivations. So, we came here to learn more about you.
While family and servants ate together, Jell Fife and his wife at the upper table and the servants at the lower one below the salt, the aliens wandered around the house. They watched the eating for a while, motionless through the long grace, listened to the harpist play from his corner for a brief period, and then went into the living room. They found five channels of the television operating. One showed a film about pirates, another a First World War battle. The third showed Ben-Hur, the fourth a Dr. Kildare film, and the fifth a science fantasy. In the manner typical of films, all apparently were set in the present. Occasional commercials featured such articles as electric razors, crossbows, aspirin, home permanent kits, and magic love charms. In the morning, Jell Fife and his wife told their guests their usual daily routine.
We generally do a little farming in the morning and sports in the afternoon, and then a siesta and supper.
The aliens watched the routine for 2 weeks. Sometimes a gardener would sit on the terrace and operate the remote-controlled farming machinery while Jell Fife sweated with scythe or hoe in the fields. Sometimes Jell Fife would sit at the small control box while the servants worked with rake or shovel. They saw Woodward open frozen food containers and cook the foods on a wood-burning range. Once a day, the mail truck came speeding up the road, its jet leaving a long roar behind it. Every other day, the supplies came in on the railroad behind the tiny chugging steam engine that had been resurrected from the Smithsonian Institution. Sometimes, in the afternoon, Jell Fife and his staff would dress in light mail armor and, mounted on armored horses, practice with lances at targets. The small electric-powered planes would swoop and dive about the field while the horsemen thundered after them, occasionally catching one on the end of a spear, at which time the others would shout in triumph. On other days, they would have contests with slings or simply throw stones by hand at straw-filled dummies. Other sports included skeet shooting, midget automobile racing, fencing, discus throwing, and sailing races in small catboats on the lake. Several times, DeVere brought out small vehicles with an elaborate covered apparatus on the hood. Each had levers, dials, and a telescopic sight. One of the humans would get into each vehicle and aim the sights at the great needle lying on its target in the distant field. He would manipulate the controls, and presently the needle would rise into the air some 60 or 70 feet. It would then fall point first onto the target. As far as the aliens could tell, the object of the game was to drop the needle in the exact center of the target. They asked no questions about the energies used in the game, and no information was volunteered. Evenings, they listened to the harpist or watched groups of players put on short skits in the living room. The humans looked at television, listened to a crystal set, played chess, go, dominoes, and checkers, read, talked, and occasionally got drunk. At the end of the second week, the two aliens suddenly announced that they had to leave and asked Jell Fife to signal their ship. They refused to give reasons, and 2 hours later, the sphere closed around them and slowly floated up to the cylinder. Several hours later, the cylinder gathered speed and moved rapidly out into space. Woodward again faced the general counsel, DeVere and Jell Fife at each side of him. This time, the atmosphere was much more cheerful. Woodward was smiling as he continued,
"It was not too difficult once we made the analysis of the message. We were taking a terrific chance, of course, but the chance of some sort had to be taken. We were in a corner and had to do something. The fact that they left early proves we were right. They had obviously been listening to our radio programs. That was the most likely way they would have learned English. and the programs concern all kinds of people, all kinds of adventures. Our best analyses were that they were rigid, somewhat hostile organisms who had probably made an analysis of us on the basis of our planetary conditions as well as our radio programs. They seemed to be making a check on their predictions when they sent us ambassadors. Now then, on the basis of our analyses, we felt that they would check their predictions once or twice and then act on them. If their predictions failed in unexpected ways, they would probably withdraw and find real emotional difficulty in reattacking the problem. And this should mean, we hope, that we will not see them again until we are ready to make contact. Now, of course, this is not ideal. Trade and information exchange would be much better, but neither race is now ready for contact. We both need more maturing. In particular, now when we are in the hopelessly inferior position scientifically, contact between us would certainly lead to our being badly exploited. In the future, if we catch up, and the evidence is that we will catch up, things may be different. When we finish analyzing all our new information, everything that was said by anyone on the estate was, of course, picked up on hidden microphones and recorded, then we shall have an excellent store of knowledge about the aliens, their personality structure, even some of their science. The estate was set up so they could form no adequate picture of us. The human inhabitants apparently followed a routine, but the things they did were taken from every age and every culture. We even faked one technique so they would be further hampered in their assessment of us. We buried large coils in the ground, rigged them so a heavy electrical charge flowing through them would throw their needle high in the air, and then it would fall back point first. It looked as though those contraptions mounted on the little cars made the needle go up into the air. In reality, of course, underground wires led out of the valley, and our technicians there were tipped off by signals given off when the driver fiddled with the dials. In short, gentlemen, we have come to a major crisis. We have learned a great deal from it. When we meet the aliens next time, it will be on much more even terms.
Woodward sat down to thunderous applause. As their ship went into overdrive, Inot and Kay Sid were just finishing their report. Inot said into the recorder while the entire crew listened,
"In conclusion, this is an essentially primitive life class, too unsure of its young sciences to meet us openly. They know of only aggressive, hostile organisms and have never observed a peaceful, friendly form of life, and so could not conceive of one. Doubtless, they projected their own rigidity and hostilities onto us, and so saw our advanced science as dangerous to them. They therefore attempted to trick us, using cultural techniques from many of their past ages. Naturally, they did not realize that if our physical sciences were more advanced than theirs, our social sciences would be similarly advanced. And it was no difficult trick to analyze them through the screens they attempted to throw up. We were careful what we said near their recording instruments and made sure they learned a good deal that they can use in advancing both their physical and social sciences. When we accomplished our purpose, we left. When we next make contact, they should be more mature. We will then be able to treat them as we wish to, as equals and as colleagues. They will be wiser, more advanced. And, in short, when we next meet these aliens, that it will be on much more even terms. You've heard Crisis, a story by Edward Glendon, copyright 1951, by Streets and Smith. I'm Michael Hansen, technical operation for this program by Mike Burns. Mindwebs is a production of WHA Radio, Madison.